Today on Maine Calling, some good news from the world of birds. We've all heard about the shocking and discouraging decline in bird populations worldwide, but there are also bird conservation success stories to celebrate. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, what has worked in bird conservation? Why is that important to humankind? And what can these successful efforts teach us about saving other species? In his new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, author and researcher Scott Weidensahl writes about bird species that are thriving, some of which once neared extinction. He and UNE bird conservation expert Noah Perlett join us to discuss some of the inspirational projects and people who have been saving birds for decades. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Have you ever encountered an injured wild animal and wondered what you should do about it? Today, we will learn what can be done, and we'll learn about some of the people in Maine who dedicate themselves to rescuing wildlife. Joining me for this hour, Bethany Brown, who is Executive Director of Saco River Wildlife Center, Barbara Haney, who is Executive Director of Avian Haven, and Laura McPherson, who is Wildlife Outreach Coordinator with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And we want to mention that this show, we're doing the show today because we are tying this to an episode of Maine Public Television's outdoor show, Borealis. The episode that will air this evening, the new episode, features the Maine Wildlife Park. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever tried to save an animal that seemed hurt? What questions do you have about the best way to help wildlife, or do you have a good story to tell? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and I want to start by asking those of you who run wildlife centers, you know, we're having this conversation on a beautiful spring day, and I'm sure your organizations are already getting calls. I'm wondering what kind of rescue calls come in this time of year. What are people likely to be encountering when they go on a walk? Bethany.
Well, currently, the species that we find the most is baby squirrels. We've currently taken in probably over 50 baby squirrels, and that's the most common one, although baby porcupines are also one of the most common ones that we're getting right now.
Okay, so baby squirrels and baby porcupines. How do you know, Bethany, when you get a call that this is indeed an animal that needs help as opposed to something that their mom is just out looking for some food?
We have actually gotten quite a few calls where we were able to reunite. We have a series of questions that we ask them. Especially if an animal comes walking up to you, or is you see an animal deceased in the road, then you know that that one's definitely going to be an orphan. So we run through a series of questions and make sure that the animal is definitely orphaned before we take it in.
Barbara, what about you? What about this time of year?
Well, we're starting to see the babies as well. We had a orphaned great horned owl baby that we could not re-nest that came in yesterday. Wow. And yeah, it's definitely baby season. You know, as the leaves start to emerge on the tree, that's when we start to see those baby birds start to appear. So yeah, this is definitely our busy season. In fact, you know, we take in about 90% of all the animals that come in the year between May and September. So we're really nesting for this busy season and getting ready.
Well, tell me about that owl, Barbara. If an owl comes to you as a baby, What will you do, and is there a good chance that it can be released to the wild someday?
Absolutely. I mean, our goal is to get every single animal back into the wild. We're gonna try to attend to it from a nutritional standpoint. That's the first thing. And then, depending on what comes in, and we really don't know, the cool thing about wildlife rehab is you really have to be a MacGyver. You have to make things up. You have to work with other animals. Sometimes we have surrogate animals that we work with that can help these animals to understand what it is to be a great horned owl. If we have more than one, that's always great. We want to get them to grow up together with others of their same species. So it's very challenging. And wildlife rehab is an emerging field. We are learning as we go here. And I would say in the last, say, 20 years, it's really improved quite a bit from just sort of the person that's interested and just brings these animals in to their home and does, whatever they think is appropriate for that animal, that we've created best practices when it comes to wildlife rehab.
That's really interesting to hear. Lauren, I want to turn to you and I want to correct your title. You are a wildlife biologist. I'm sorry to introduce you incorrectly. Bethany and Barbara represent two of the larger and more well-established wildlife rehab organizations in Maine, but they are only two of many. Tell me about the whole network of wildlife rehab organizations in Maine, and also how someone knows who to call if they find an injured animal.
Yeah, so the department is responsible for permitting our wildlife rehabbers. They go through quite the process to become permitted. They're expected to have quite a bit of experience and hands-on opportunities before they get a permit through us. And so, these folks are really well equipped to handle these wildlife species that are injured or sick. And so we have a wonderful network of our rehabbers that primarily, a lot of them exist within our central and southern area of the state, where a lot of conflict, if you will, occurs, or more human-wildlife interactions occur. And so that network is something that's been incredibly productive for us when we, when our staff is reached out to by the public and somebody has found an animal that needs and requires rehab. Having those relationships with our rehabbers has been an excellent opportunity to ensure that when we can, those species can get the care that they need. We've also been working on developing a program with our wildlife conflict agents, which are folks that are contracted through us. They work for the department and essentially folks that find some of these injured or sick animals. We can utilize those WCAs, we call them wildlife conflict agents, to go out, assess the situation, see if maybe they really are a species that requires help, or maybe they're just, mom is gone, looking for food. So we have somebody that can be deployed and kind of give the opportunity to assess that situation before that animal is taken and transported to a rehabber. But for somebody who has found an animal and maybe needs assistance, calling our info center is a great way to find somebody that can help. What we do is that person who answers the phone at the agency will sort of send that call to dispatch, who is then instructed to contact the closest WCA, wildlife conflict agent, to that area, and they can be deployed to assess the situation and help out.
Do you know off the top of your head what the number for the information center at the agency is?
I believe it's 207-287-8000.
Okay, great. And what about if somebody just calls their local fire department or police department? Are they likely to know who the right person to contact is?
Certainly, you can give that number, but state dispatch, which I don't have that number off the top of my head, is who is directed to funnel those phone calls to our WCAs. So if they know the state dispatch number, they can absolutely go that route.
Bethany, you were going to jump in.
I actually work very, very closely with the wildlife conflict agents, and there's the state number is 207-624-7076 and extension 9, and then just ask them, let them know what you have, and then they'll get a wildlife conflict agent right out. We work very, very closely with them, especially Bobby Joe, and she has been, they have been such a godsend, because we, our call volume kind of dropped, which is great, because our animals over the past 5 years have increased. In 2019, we took in about 242 animals, and then last year was 1,243 animals. So the wildlife conflict agents have been a huge blessing. I can't even imagine what the numbers would be if we didn't have them. So,
Lauren, are wildlife contact agents, is this a fairly new program? Bethany talking about the fact that her numbers have gone down as the wildlife contact agents have been deployed.
Yep, wildlife conflict agents, just as a correction.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's been a couple folks on for about 5 years that, you know, handled as much as they could, you know, the capacity they had with it for two individuals, but we've been expanding it every year. And so this year, we plan to have 10 positions throughout the state, three of them in sort of the southern area, three in the central area, two sort of in the little north of Bangor, and then one up in the Presque Isle area. So we're starting to get full coverage throughout the state where they can assist us in these situations. So it's great to add that capacity.
So I want to take some time to have some stories about happy endings. And Barbara, I know that you have a story about a bald eagle that was found in Cape Elizabeth. So tell us about that.
You know, I'm fairly new in this position as executive director. This is my sixth week here.
Oh, boy,
and so,
welcome.
You know, thank you so much. I've had a long and illustrious career in wildlife rehab, and there's no place else I would rather be than to move to Maine to finish off my final years. And I'm not familiar exactly with that story, but what I can say is that we take in about 3,000 animals a year, 3,000 wild birds
wow.
a year of 130 species, which includes, you know, just sort of the everyday species that we get in. But also we do specialize in loons and eagles as well. And there've been quite a few eagles that have come in just in the last month that I've been there. And I've witnessed just an incredible amount of skill. The Avian Haven, Mainers should be very, very proud of what is happening at Avian Haven. 25 years of experience caring for Maine's birds. It's absolutely astonishing. The flight enclosures are the best in the country. I've been familiar with Avian Haven from a national level of being on the program committee for the National Wildlife Rehab Association. We were familiar with what was happening here in Freedom, Maine, based on their absolutely stunning flight enclosures, and they also have loon pools and everything else to really help these animals to be conditioned and properly able to be released back into the wild. I'm sorry I don't know the specifics about that particular eagle, but I'm sure it's fantastic.
That's okay, Barbara. It was a bald eagle that apparently had been hit by a car and was able to be rehabbed. But I'm so interested in the fact that you say you've had several eagles already in this month. What are their injuries and what are their prognoses?
Well, you know, most of the birds that come to us, it's based on human intervention and human activity. We see a lot of window strikes, a lot of vehicle collisions. We've seen eagles that get hit by cars. Also, eagles are unfortunately suffering from lead toxicity, and that's huge. Almost every eagle that comes in has some form of lead poisoning, and this is huge. And this is something that over time we've learned that we can change some of our behaviors, and it really can affect wildlife and our ecosystems dramatically. And I would love to see that we start to make little changes that to get lead out of the environment, so it's not so toxic for our beautiful eagles that are all over the place here in Maine.
I know there's been a movement to get lead out of fishing gear. Are there other common ways in which eagles ingest it?
I think the main culprit is lead shot, and there are alternatives for hunters to use other than lead that are just as work just as well. So I think that there is a push to kind of for education and also legislation to be able to sort of mitigate the harm that lead shot in particular causes on our sovereign wildlife.
All right. And Bethany, I'm just blown away by Avian Haven's number of helping 3,000 birds a year. Tell us about your numbers. I have a feeling I'm going to be blown away as well.
Well, currently, I'm not sure if everybody knows, but we are still operating out of my home, which is in the basement of my home. And we started with, like I said, 2019, we only did about 242 animals. And in my basement and on my 3 acres, we've expanded to over almost 1,300 animals. So we've definitely outgrown. And this year, I foresee probably closer to 1,500 animals. Just in that small space, but we are actually moving to a new facility in June, which is going to be wonderful, so we can really expand. We also have wonderful sub-permittees who are able to take maybe a litter or two home and be able to rehab them and then bring them back as soon as they're ready to go out in our outside enclosures. So that's a huge help.
Lauren, if somebody wants to become a sub-permittee or a wildlife rehabilitator, what is the process? What kind of training? What kind of, is there testing? How does it work?
Yep. So they would have to submit an application to the department, and myself and a few others handle that. There's an expectation of 100 hours of hands-on experience, sort of an internship, if you will. It can be 50 hours can be replaced with a bachelor's degree in an appropriate field. There is a test that they would have to go through. There would have to be a facility site inspection that they would have to pass. And so, you know, our standards are high because, you know, our interest is in the welfare of the wildlife. And we want to make sure that they're going into somebody's hands that are knowledgeable, know what they're doing. The facility is clean. We want to make sure that we're always reducing the potential of disease. And so we try to keep an eye on everybody as best as possible. I think everyone's intentions, you know, wildlife rehabbers, certainly their missions are more specific to helping that individual animal. And that's wonderful, and that can be a really useful tool where appropriate. And our mission as a state wildlife agency is to ensure that our populations as a whole are healthy and abundant, but you know, not spreading disease or putting an individual above the population. So,
I realize, Bethany, I have not asked you about a good story. I do need to go to a break, but I will ask you in the next part of the program. We are talking about wildlife rehabilitation, what to do if you encounter an injured animal. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, when to know if wild animals need saving, and if they do, what to do about it. My guest, Laura McPherson, a wildlife biologist with Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, Bethany Brown, executive director of the Saco River Wildlife Center, and Barbara Haney, the Avian Haven's executive director, new executive director there. We invite you to join the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Okay, Bethany, your turn. What is the story that you just can't wait to tell?
One of my favorite stories to tell is we work very closely with the Portland Police Department and the ACO there, Rue Weist. We got a call later in the evening, probably about 9:30, 10 o'clock, on a raccoon, a young one that had been shot with arrows and was stuck in some bushes. Thankfully, the officers were able to get it back to the police station, and they had cut the arrows down some so that when I got there, I was able to get the raccoon into a carrier. But I was absolutely stunned that this poor animal was still alive with two arrows sticking out of it. I called my vet and let her know that I was on the way back to the center, and she met me there. And it's probably like 10:30 at night by now. The miraculous story about him is nothing major was hit, and he had just minor injuries, even though he had two arrows in his body. and he made a full recovery, and we were able to release him back into the wild. That story for me is just one of my favorite ones, because the gentleman who found him heard some rustling in the bushes and kind of peeked in the bushes and contacted the state Portland Police Department, and they knew exactly what to do and who to call. And it was a wonderful story.
Can I ask you, did you release him back into Portland, or did you take him somewhere a little more wild?
We actually were able to get him close to where he was, just a little bit more, I guess you could say, rural in Portland. So he came from an area where there was some woods, so we were able to get him right back there.
Lauren, I wanted to ask you about when to leave an animal alone and when to call. I mean, obviously, this man that Bethany's talking about saw a raccoon with arrows sticking out of him. That's a pretty easy call, but there are a lot of times when it's not so easy to tell, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Not every situation warrants intervention. You know, the public, the general public has great intentions. You know, they come across an animal they find alone or, you know, may seem unusual to them. And oftentimes they'll pick it up and attempt to bring it to a rehabber. You know, that's something that we try to discourage. We want to keep wildlife as wild as possible and limit intervention to when it's only absolutely necessary. So many times, especially in the coming weeks, fawns will be a big one, especially in central and southern Maine. Mothers will, you know, does will leave their fawns for hours and hours, sometimes a half a day or a full day. So our information and education division, along with myself and others, have put together information for folks to follow if they find an animal, a fawn that may seem like it's alone, maybe it needs intervention, but sort of provides a step down approach to evaluating whether or not that animal truly needs intervention and needs to be rehabbed, or if you should just leave it alone and allow the mom to come back. So a lot of those situations, again, they're the best of intentions, but we need to consider when it's most appropriate to actually intervene and bring an animal to a rehabber. And there are occasions, you know, if an animal is exhibiting neurological issues, oftentimes that can be a sign, depending on the species, it can be a sign of rabies or another really detrimental disease. And so the agency is, you know, always trying to balance that approach, right? We care about the individual animal, but again, we don't want to put it above populations. And so there are certain circumstances where we feel it's not appropriate to go to a rehab, or if it does, then, you know, it will likely be euthanized because we don't want to see it go back into a situation where it could spread disease. But yeah, it's certainly taking a moment to evaluate whether or not intervention is needed, calling a rehabber to really see if that's appropriate. Those wildlife conflict agents are going to be a useful tool in that method as well, evaluating the situation. And there are just times where not taking matters into your own hands is the best route possible.
Yeah. And if people learn one thing today, what you said about fawns, that a mother can leave them for as long as half a day. So if you find a fawn and then you go back a couple hours later and it's still there, it very well could be fine.
Yep. Yep. And yeah. Sometimes, you know, they're making noise. That's normal. Occasionally, you know, if they were showing significant signs of dehydration, a listing head or droopy ears or maggots or a lot of flies on it, that may indicate that it's been truly abandoned and could need intervention. But oftentimes it's difficult for your average person to really evaluate that. And then there's this misconception in some people that once you touch the animal that the mother won't accept it. And that's not the case. So there have been occasions where someone will call and will say, put it back. She'll be back. So leaving the young to, you know, make sure mom comes back is the best way to check it out. Make sure that it's really in need of intervention.
Well, here's a related story. This is an email from Frank. I found a fledgling that left its nest before it could fly. It was on our front porch one morning. And it was still there when I got home from work. So I called Booth Bay Animal Control and they advised me to place the bird in a box and bring it to them, which I did. To my great surprise, they called me the next day and said, you can come pick up the bird now. I was completely caught off guard by this, but they told me to place the baby bird on the ground near the nest and the mother would look after its baby. Sure enough, the mom perched herself on a fence opposite the baby and vigorously chirped at it, which in bird speak must have sounded like, "Get up, get up, you can do it, you can fly, come on." The encouragement worked. The fledgling took flight shortly thereafter. So cool. Barbara, you're smiling. This is a story that you've heard over and over again, right?
I love this. Yeah. You know, I always describe fledglings as sort of that late teen that you're trying to get, that's living in your basement and you're trying to get it out of the house. You know, you know, fledglings, the parents are kind of like, you're done. It's time for you to go. And frankly, they need to get out of the nest to really be able to do that final development. And so they can't fly. They're just bouncing around. They are a little vulnerable, but the parents are nearby. And, you know, it's always great. This is just yet another example of why you really, instead of stepping forward into this situation, step back and analyze it. And if humans, if we're getting in the way, if we're concerned, we're keeping the parents from being able to take care of those fledglings, which they will continue to do even as the fledgling is out of the nest. So yeah, that's a really calming call that we're going to get. I see a bird, it's not flying, it needs help. Well, fledglings don't need help. They need their parents to keep encouraging them to get out of the basement, so to speak, and become grown-ups. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference, right? There's fledglings and there's nestlings, and that's where we can come kind of help. And the nice thing is everyone can send pictures now via their cell phone. So it's really easy for us to help them, to help analyze what's going on. Does this bird really need help?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, you listen to Frank's story, Barbara, and if he saw the bird before he went to work and after he came home, you can understand why he was concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Those teenage fledglings are stubborn sometimes. Yeah, it's normal. And sometimes, you know, you never know with animals. Sometimes they just need to hunker down. And we make a lot of assumptions about animals, and we really just simply don't know. It might have been a hot day. You know, we don't understand the timing of how these things happen. But it's fun to watch and observe. And who knows, sometimes we don't know. We're going to take that animal in and maybe we're going to look, give it a once over and then say, okay, get it back. And we're able to do that as well. Having these numbers of wildlife rehabbers in your phone right now is very important, because that phone call is essential before doing anything.
Joining us now is Linda Dowdy, who's Executive Director of the Marine Mammals of Maine. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You know, you were just listening to Barbara talking about sometimes it's best to just leave young birds alone. You could say the same thing about seals, couldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. We're heading to that time of year that the baby's being born along the coast of Maine.
Wow. I understand that you have quite a story from just this month, a seal entangled at a beach in Kennebunkport. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we got a report of a seal that was swimming close to a buoy in a mooring ball, and that they thought the animal was entangled. And sometimes we do get calls for that seals like to play around and are curious. So sometimes they will play with mooring balls or other buoys out there, but so that 9 times out of 10, the animal's not entangled, but this time the animal was entangled in the chain that was actually attached to the mooring ball into the hip area and hind end flippers. And so the animal was struggling to breathe and was going to expire if he stayed there.
Mm.
So we were able to work with the local harbor master, who was Frank Orr, that ended up helping us bring his own dinghy out, and myself and Dominique, who's our assistant training coordinator, paddled out to the animal, and we actually had to bring the animal into the dinghy with us, which wasn't very big to start with. So putting a live angry seal onto a small dinghy that's entangled was, you know, not just for anybody to handle. And
seals are a bit slippery, right?
Yes. So And trying to bring, you know, weight onto an animal and a thrashing animal. So trying to keep everybody safe and keep the animal safe, not make more damage to the animal by being entangled, because we didn't know exactly how the animal, what it could be, how it was being harmed in what it was entangled in. So just assessing that, too. So we were able to cut the animal free, but the chain, we had to then try to disentangle the chain off the animal that was around it. And then we did decide to bring the animal in for further evaluation just because of some of the swelling on the hind flippers. And the animal seemed to be doing well once back at our rehab center. And then we were able to satellite tag that animal individual so we can monitor the post-release efforts to make sure the animal's still doing well. So right now he's actually bouncing back off from the Kennebunk Old Orchard, Ogunquit area as of this morning. So he's still staying in Maine right now.
Oh, great. Well, congratulations on that one, Linda. How many seals and other marine mammals do you treat each year?
So we're roughly, for the animals that come through our center, we're about 40 to 50 animals a year, and we respond to about 300 to 400 individual animal cases on average.
I know, was it last year or the year before that one of the sad things that you were encountering was avian flu? Is that happening again this year?
So, yeah, that was the first time documented in the United States was in June of 2022. We started to get an increase of deceased animals in a short amount of time, or even live animals that were soon expiring after 12 to 24 hours. And there is another virus in their environment, Faucian distemper virus, that could potentially cause that too, but we had been a little bit on alert that avian influenza could cross over into seals, which it hadn't, but we were actually doing testing on all animals that we were handling, and we knew, we work with Tufts Medical Center in veterinary program in Massachusetts, and then they ended up, we sent our samples to them as soon as we thought we had a suspect case, and they got back to us within 24 hours and said, yes, this animal does have the high path avian influenza. And so we ended up, we were in this die-off of seals that were, you know, if they contracted it, they were dying within 12 to 24 hours. And
oh, that's
so there
so
was
sad.
No cure for it. And we were lucky that we didn't actually bring that individual into our center, which would have been a death wish for the animals in our current care at the time. And so we actually had to separate our whole team out between live versus deceased responding because we couldn't, it was so highly contagious that we couldn't expose other animals to it as well. So it was a new thing for us. It definitely made us more aware that, you know, the being protecting wildlife is important, and also protecting people, that one health, that things can cross over. So just making sure everybody is doing the due diligence, but also getting to pinpoint exactly what the cause was at the time, which sometimes if you were not monitoring those type of things, we wouldn't have known potentially what it was.
Yeah, well, Linda, thank you so much for calling and for the work that you do. Linda Dowdy, the Executive Director of Marine Mammals in Maine. Before you go, Linda, what's your hotline?
1-800-532-9551.
All right.
Thank
thank you so much, and good luck this summer. I need to go to you, Barbara. Are you seeing cases of avian flu in the birds you're rescuing?
Yes, we are. That is another issue with bald eagles as well. We've sent numerous tests out to Tufts in the last few months, and we are getting back positives. We're mainly, you know, so ducks and diving ducks, they're sort of the they're carrying it, so they're bringing it through migration and things, and they're also, they don't have symptoms, so they're symptomless. But what's happening is it's the animals that eat, right? So it is some of these scavengers that are getting it. And unfortunately, we're seeing it in raptors and scavengers, and not so much in songbirds, although there have been a couple of cases in songbirds. It's highly unlikely in songbirds. But yeah, it is a huge problem. And from an organizational standpoint, it also adds an additional difficulty to being able to handle these 3,000 birds, because we have to have animals in quarantine. We're waiting for tests to come back. Volunteers and staff have to suit up for PPE just to check these animals out. So it's been a tough few years since we've had been dealing with high path avian influenza, and it's changing populations as well. I mean, the state of the birds report came out, and unfortunately, we're seeing decreases in every single sector of birds in populations. And so anything we can do as wildlife rehabbers really does make a difference, not only for those birds, but it also gives us an opportunity to do something and to be compassionate about the state of birds.
Well, that's so sad to hear. We are going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking today about rescuing wildlife, and we're talking to wildlife rehabilitators. Three experts with me today: Barbara Haney with Avian Haven, Lauren McPherson, a wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Bethany Brown with Saco River Wildlife Center. If you're quick, you can send a quick email, talk@mainepublic.org, or join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Maggie. While mowing, a mom groundhog started carrying her babies across my lawn. I stopped mowing. When she seemed to be done, after taking so many babies, I started to mow again. Oops, one baby was left behind, and it followed me, came up to me close. I thought the mom had abandoned it. So I led the youngster out to the lawn. Eventually, mom came back to get the baby. The baby wanted me, but I knew to let it be. P.S. That baby would have followed me into the house. So, Bethany, you know, people are encountering sometimes strange behavior on animals, and it's completely understandable why they think that animal might need help.
Yep. So that's why whenever we get phone calls, we always ask for the scenario. We always ask for videos, pictures, anything possible. And if there is a mom on site, we always, always encourage them just to leave the babies for anyways up to 24 hours for any signs that mom will take them back. And that was perfect what she did.
We'll go to Nikki calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Nikki. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and hi, experts. What a great program today. I just wanted to share a quick story. I was driving in Saco about a year and a half ago, and I drove past what looked like just a pile of gray rags. I got about a block away, and I turned around and came back because I thought that didn't look right. What it was a little barred owl that apparently had flown headfirst into a car. It was standing by the side of the road, completely dazed. So I sat in my car and waited to see if it would fly. And when it didn't, I ended up calling the police department in Saco, and a very nice young policeman came down, and he said, "We'll get in touch with someone, and I'll wait here until they come to pick the owl up." So I left, and then I came back to make sure he was still there, and he was, and so was the owl. And eventually the owl ended up later that day at the Center for Wildlife in Cape Nettic. And I got a call from them about 6 months later. And they said, "We just wanted to let you know that your owl has had a complete recovery." They said, "We found a parasite that probably she would have had for her entire life, so we removed that. But she's had a complete recovery and has been released." So I just wanted to share that story and a shout out to the Maine Center for Wildlife in Cape Nettic.
Well, Nikki, thank you so much for that story, and congratulations to you. I have a question here from Fran. Could you speak to reptilian rescue, turtles, snakes, and also possums that you find on the side of the road? So go ahead, Bethany.
Well, we do some turtles and some snakes and other reptiles, but we don't do very many. We actually partner with, we used to partner with Avian Haven. I guess they don't do turtles anymore. I guess there's a new one that does turtles, but we send everything down to Center for Wildlife for that. But possums, we've taken in last year about 250 opossums. So one of the big things that we always get possums babies is when people see them on the side of the road, the moms get hit. I always encourage people, no matter what, even if you think the mom is deceased, stop and check the pouches. And if you find babies and you're not comfortable taking them off, you can bring us the whole mom and then we can go ahead and do that. Wow. But that's, I would say that's probably 50% of our possum babies come in from moms being hit by cars. And we have had success stories where we had one mom that was hit by a car. And she had 13 babies, little tiny babies, and we kept her with us because she had a couple of minor issues where she couldn't be released right away. So we had her in a nice enclosure inside, and we were able to get them, the babies, up to release size, and mom and babies were able to be released together. But if it wasn't for the nice person that stopped and checked her, God knows how long she would have laid there and probably suffered and ended up not making it. So
Bethany, I've never handled a possum. Would it be easy for me to tell if there are babies in the pouch? Is that something that it doesn't take an expert to figure out?
Depending on the size of the baby, because when they're really, really tiny, they could be the size of a peanut. But a lot of time, I've even had people, when the mom was hit, the babies were scattered everywhere. So she ended up literally searching the roadside and into the woods a little bit and found the babies, because when the mom was hit, they kind of like flew off of her or flew out of her. So usually you can tell if they're big enough. I always say carry gloves with you. So if you do have to check in the pouch, that way, you know, you don't get your hands dirty or anything, and you never want to touch a wild animal without gloves. But yeah, if you can check into the pouch, if they're big enough, it's going to be pretty obvious.
All right. And then also I wanted to ask you, is there a window? What months are you likely to find this?
We've actually seen moms with babies as late as December, which is very, very unusual. And then we've also seen them as early as February. Rare, but we do see them in that time.
Okay. Lauren. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Lauren.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Bethany mentioned wearing gloves and protective gear when handling wildlife. We really try to encourage folks, you know, there's certain circumstances where they might feel comfortable putting some babies into a box or something like that. But it's not uncommon for folks to find baby raccoons or species that are very commonly carrying rabies, and they'll handle them. You know, they might hang out with them for a while. And unfortunately, you sometimes can't tell that something's harboring rabies until it's too late, right? So we want to make sure that we're always putting human safety above everything. And so unfortunately, what happens in those situations, if someone has been exposed to a rabies vector species, we do end up euthanizing that animal, certainly humanely, but we have to test them for rabies to ensure that human hasn't been exposed to a potential case. It does absolutely happen. And so, you know, there's, especially with social media, there's a lot of folks out there who will look at videos of people caring for baby wildlife, caring for an animal that was abandoned. They have this idea based on social media that it's easy to care for an animal, for a wild animal. That's not the case. That's why we have certified rehabbers. And we always want to discourage folks taking things into their own hands, because they might not realize what they're exposing themselves to and things of that nature. So certainly we discourage folks handling them themselves unless they are really, truly, you know, they know they're not getting any exposure. But rarely that's the case that people are handling things appropriately. So again, reaching out to a wildlife conflict agent or a biologist can kind of help you handle that situation.
Lauren, I want to kind of circle back to the beginning and ask you a big question, and I'm going to try to ask this in a nice way. At the very beginning, Bethany mentioned that she has a lot of squirrels right now, and I'm sure there are people in my audience thinking of squirrels as a nuisance, or maybe another animal as a nuisance. Bethany, I should have asked you, in the cities around Maine, they're capturing and killing rats, you know? So Lauren, how does one think through Oh gosh, I hate putting it this way, but I can't think of another way. What animals are worth saving?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think it's one that, you know, we all struggle with a little bit. Everyone has a big heart for wildlife. Folks that work at the agency, we all are wildlife lovers. And of course, our rehabbers are, people from the public. Our mission as an agency is to protect, preserve, and enhance wildlife. And we do that by conducting research, monitoring, and with that data, what we're trying to do is ensure that the populations of those species are healthy. And so frequently people in the public think, okay, a healthy population means that we have an enormous population, right? There's a lot of them. They kind of go by numbers, but that isn't indicative of a healthy population. What we really want to do is manage populations for what's called a carrying capacity. So what the landscape can sustain and adequately provide for a population, food, shelter, water, things of that nature. And we want to make sure that they're not reaching a limit where they're spreading disease. And so there's a lot of species, most of our species in Maine, all of our species in Maine are monitored really well. They're very abundant. And so there's many species like fox and raccoon, where we utilize recreational trapping or for deer, you know, hunting, where we limit those populations a little bit to that appropriate capacity so that we don't see negative impacts on the habitat or on each other or increased conflict with humans. For species that are protected, endangered, threatened, or species of concern, you know, those are species that we're certainly going to put in more effort to make sure that an individual is cared for. But, you know, certainly we think every individual does matter, but again, we're always looking at the population level and how we're best managing that.
Thanks for that. I'm going to ask Barbara this question, and we've put this photo up in our Zoom chat so Barbara can see it. Somebody, Sheila, has sent a photo of a bird, we think maybe a mourning dove, sitting on top of a car. Says, is this baby okay? So Barbara, I'll just ask it this way. If someone finds a baby bird sitting on their car, apparently roosting on their car, what's your advice to them, especially if they need to use that car to go to work?
Well, when I look at that, I don't see a baby. I think that looks a little bit older than a baby. And it's really hard to know. I mean, sometimes birds just need to rest for a minute. So I would say, you know, take note of it. And maybe approach it. If you do need to get in your car, just approach and see if it acts normal, which is to say, fly away. And maybe wait a moment, if you can wait and see what happens. But just from that picture, it would be really hard to tell. And we would say, you know, have a little patience and let's see what happens.
Okay. And I want to go to this email from Susan. Susan asks, how can I help rescuers with needed supplies? I know money would always be welcome, but what about other types of donations? Food, towels, crates, bedding, fur coats? Bethany.
Well, we definitely always need food, especially fresh produce, and then eggs, and then crates. We definitely can use crates, but we'd use a lot of carriers, medium sized carriers, because when we want to do releases, we have to have so many crates, especially when we have to release like 10 or 15 raccoons at one time. We have to have 10 to 15 carriers. And we're switching over to a lot of Ferret Nation or Critter Nation cages. And we also use the very large dog kennels or dog crates, the metal ones with double doors, because it's much easier for us to get in and work around them without having to get too close to them.
So if someone has a dog crate in their basement and isn't using it, that might be local wildlife center will likely welcome that.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yeah. And we have just about a minute left. Barbara, what would you add to that? What could Avian Haven use?
Well, there's so much. We are having our bird baby shower that will be taking place from April 27th to May 4th. And we're going to have all sorts of fun social media posts, just like a baby shower. We're going to have games and things. And we also have a wish list on that. And there are all sorts of things, little things to big things that folks can help us out with. And we're always looking for donations. We are a nonprofit. So not only in-kind donations, but also donations to help us to keep the doors open. We're also looking for volunteers. We have 100 transport volunteers all over the state that get animals to us. So we're going to have an orientation for transport volunteers on May 3rd, I believe, that Saturday. And you can go to our website at avianhaven.org, and all that information will be up there.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. And it's a bummer. We're out of time. Bethany, were you going to join and say that you could also use volunteers?
Yes, we actually do take a lot of volunteers between transport and hands-on volunteers.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Don't forget to watch the latest episode of Maine Public's television show, Borealis. Lauren, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the Maine Wildlife Park. These are animals that were not able to be returned to the wild. Every single animal at the Maine Wildlife Park is an animal that has been rescued. Bethany Brown, Executive Director of the Saco River Wildlife Center. Barbara Haney, Executive Director of Avian Haven. And Laura McPherson, she is a biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Today's sound engineer is Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow's Arbor Day, and we're going to talk about tree care. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.